everyone. Welcome to Progressive Opinions of Color, a podcast that seeks to increase diversity of voices in conversations about politics and economics. I'm your host, Nancy Wu. I know it's hard enough to understand the economy and politics as it is, so why not hear about it from stories from real people? I have a great friend here today who I am excited for you guys to hear from, my friend David Kim. I've known him since high school. He works as a product manager in a tech company startup right now in the LA area, but he has just like a lot of cool stories to share. So we'll talk about what is economics, and I'll share some of my personal finance tips about investing and like starting a retirement account, because there's just not a lot of financial literacy in a lot of like first-gen families. And we talk about that as well. We talk about like our parents' mindsets and where they got their like political and economic mindsets from. We talk about racial microaggressions and David's family story as an undocumented Asian American. It's not a story you hear about a lot, but I'm super excited for him to share this with you guys. There's definitely a lot more about undocumented Americans that has to be shared. And that is one of the goals of this podcast, to just share stories out there. Also, I am a new podcaster. If you guys like this content, please remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Google, basically any app you use. And be sure if you use Apple Podcasts and any system that allows this, to leave a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps me a lot with being a new podcaster, with being discovered and like building credibility as I get more podcast episodes out there. So please, please help me out there. Also, this podcast now has an Instagram page. The handle is at POC Podcast. Again, everything will be in the show notes, so make sure to follow and support there. And if you don't know me in real life, shout out and like say hi, because I know my friends love listening to this, but I would love to meet some other people who are also interested in these topics. So that's it for now. Let's dive right into the episode.
For me, when I think of the economy, I'm just like, oh, like that's just a black box. Like that's just where money comes from, and that's Wall Street, you know? Like, but you know, what is the economy, Nancy? Like, tell me about it.
Economics is the study of limited resources and how to allocate them efficiently. Stats is like a big part of econ. I feel like econ is just applied stats. You get better at reading New York Times articles and being like, okay, this data is bullshit. Or you can click on the link that a research piece refers to, like, you can understand that this is bullshit. That's like one application of econ, of how we can actually use it. It's more like knowledge than like we have any control over the economy. Economics really likes to think that it's rational and logical and the ideal,
like fucking men. Like,
like all economic theory is based on this idea of like the homo economicus or whatever, which is this perfectly rational being. And it's just structured off of models that dudes came up with years ago. And no one behaves like that in real life. And sure, it's a model that is not supposed to be taken literally, but if it structures our framework of thinking about all our policy making, then we should think about what that's based off of and whether or not we need to change it. And all economics is basically taught from a profit maximization perspective, which seeks to maximize efficiency at all costs. And that's just going to hurt a lot of people. And like when that is the dominant narrative that you get taught in any economics program, you don't create very great people who are economists, because most people just only think about money and logic and not about how anyone is impacted by it.
Well, and it's literally dehumanizing, right?
It is.
Because it's like you can almost like take that framework and like apply it to ethics. So it's like, if I am hyper logical and want to succeed in this economy, then I have to be hyper about like efficiency and cutting, like, you know, giving myself as much margins as I can, you know, which doesn't speak to like human rights or like decent working conditions. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like it doesn't leave much room. And it's like very much the language of like the patriarchy and like colonialism.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
They're like, oh, you know what'd be great? You know, like, for example, like, what is it? Like neocolonialism in East Asia, where like, you know, Japanese manufacturers of cars are like outsourcing like their factory factory work to like Vietnam, but it's like the parts are specific to Japanese cars that they only can generate, like their main source of revenue is like generating this gear for like a Japanese car company. Like, you know, I feel like those parts, because some of those parts aren't universal, they can't like sell them to the United States, or they can't even expand their market. And they just like inherently like create these like dependencies, which I think is shitty. So it's like, it's still like all the language, I feel like, of like the colonizer and the patriarchy.
It is. It's all colonialism because, I mean, if you were to apply the models in practice, it would be, how do you extract limited resources? And you have to go elsewhere, because like the whole idea of Econ 101 of comparative advantage is that you get resources from places that can produce it faster and cheaper. Mm-hmm. So, and you trade things that you can, and like, that's why we go to other countries and justify it. It's also like, I remember I wanted to get my master's in the UK because I thought that schools over there would be more unorthodox and teach things about like socialist structures rather than just purely capitalist ones. And I was so wrong, because I went into that program and it was basically like a master's in imperialism, because we were studying developing countries, reading things written by white people about countries in sub-Saharan Africa or Southeast Asia, Latin America, and like white people setting up experiments there, putting people in randomized test groups to like get a relief bill or not get a relief bill, and just like screwing with people as if they're just lab rats, and then writing about policies that we should impose on these societies that we know nothing about. And like, you take away the cultural aspect, you take away the humanity of people, and you just see them as lab subjects. How do you form policies just by looking at a group of people like that? Yeah. And the problem with economics is that it does that at a mass scale for any region that it's looking at. In the United States, economic policy is also based on experiments or studies and data. And you can look at a data set and understand that the median or like the middle person does this or makes this amount of money, but you don't understand anything about all the people on the margins or the outliers who have the experiences that like are the most at need or the most vulnerable. And that stuff gets all erased when looking at economic data and making policy. So that's why like economic policy benefits the majority in the middle, but like it leaves so many people excluded because it's not diverse enough.
Yeah, but I wouldn't even say like it's the majority of the middle. I think like it's just like the first half, right? Like, and I think it's what, like, it's always going to favor the people like in the establishment, like with power and money, over the people that are lacking it.
It favors the people who are making, like the demographics of the people making the policies, because yeah, they are the only ones who have experienced their own lives, and they don't have that insight into other experiences. All yeah. of these models are based on people who are highly educated, who can afford to make logical decisions. Like, yes, it's more logical to save a certain percent of your paycheck, but it's not if you need to buy food or you worry about feeding your family in the long term and you have to spend your paycheck all at once and go into debt. Like, and going to debt, it just doesn't make sense from an economics perspective. But then,
yeah, and because like the crazy part is, right, like if a family is making $30,000 a year versus $300,000 a year, even if it's on a percentage, like the person making $30,000 a year is going to need every bit of cash that they need to like spend on rent, to spend on food, to spend on their children, as opposed to someone who makes $300,000. Like, yes, you're taking an equal, like, let's just arbitrarily say like 10% from their gross income. But like to live on that money, like month over month, like, you know, if it's the same household, like the person with $300,000 can definitely survive. And like the economy, I feel like, just doesn't take that into factor.
Yeah, the economy doesn't care that it is impossible for a lot of people to live logically. People aren't paid in a logical way.
Yeah.
It's, policies aren't set up in a logical way where people are benefited, where they could. Like, the people that economic models are based off of are not it's not the society that we actually have. And our actual society is much more divided, much more fucked up. That requires some thinking outside of the economic boxes to actually create policies that work. Like, yeah. Republicans love the idea that you give the rich more money and they will create more jobs. They will, like, trickle down economics.
Yeah.
That just doesn't hold up in practice.
No.
But in theory, it does. And, like, just reconciling that is such an impossible
argument. I feel like a part of that, it's like we look at it in aggregate, right? Like, we look at the economy overall. But it's like, you know, where's the case study that says, like, hey, like, we gave $10 million tax break to, like, a specific company in that's in California. You know, we're tracking their spending as a company, right? And, like, the company pays another company. They're able to, like, do more R&D. Like, they outsource, like, more of their things. Like, there's trade going on. It, like, revitalized the industry. But it's, like, there's no case study that says, like, how much of that actually ended up in a pocket of a worker that can spend on the local economy rather than, like, how much of that money is going to the corporation. And it's just, like, a circle jerk of, like, tax breaks, right? Like, you know, I get a $10 million tax break, you get a $10 million tax break, and that's none of that's going towards, like, our employees proper. Like, that's not going to the janitor. Like, that's going to go to, like, the VPs and the exec.
It's really fucked up. The way that taxes are structured in general benefits the richest people because the tax on your return on investments is so low. It's, like, 15% or something.
Yeah, it's not the same rate as income tax, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, and, like, who the hell, like, the people who are actually investing and making a profit off of it, it's not going to be people who actually need a tax break to pay their bills.
And what's really funny is, like, some people in the office are talking to me about, like, investing my money.
You definitely should.
Yeah. And they're just, like, just invest. They're, like, do it. And I'm, like... And I don't know, like, where to even start, right? Because it's like, I understand, like, right now I have a savings account that yields 2% a year, but I can potentially open a different account by investing my money and get maybe like 8% back a year. But, like, where do I start with that? Like, people are telling me to invest and that if I want a crash course from them, I can, like, maybe do it. But it's like, what are the avenues for investing? Like, I know, like, what, fucking, like, Robin Hood, and you can, like, manage your own portfolio or whatever. But, like, I feel like people that are, like, really into investing, they, like, do all of their research. They're, like, using Robin Hood. They're buying cryptocurrency. Like, they're doing all of that. And then there's me. I'm just like, okay, like, I'm just going to open my bank account because it's, like, I can just let my money sit there and not worry about anything.
My parents feel the same way, and I want there to be investment literacy across communities, especially communities of color, because I don't think we understand this as well. And it's what makes rich white people and the establishment richer and richer. And it's really simple. Like, when you put your money in a bank, if you have, like, savings and you put it in a bank, yeah, it grows the rate of inflation. At worst, you put it in your checking account and it actually doesn't grow. So you're losing 2% a year effectively. But if you put it in an investment account, and I'll go into the steps of that, but say you put them into the S&P 500, tracing the companies in the US. If you look at a trend over time, it's been going up consistently. There are dips during recessions, but on average, it grows by 8% a year, 10% a year, minus recessions, minus taxes, you get a 6% return at a safe bet year over year. There is a calculation where if you compound like 6% on this amount and then 6% on that higher amount and then that over time throughout from now, your late 20s until your retirement.
It basically rises by 10 to 20 times. So you put in $10,000 now, take it out in 50 years, you have over $100,000. With 6%, you have like $180,000. And that's just from adding $10,000 one time. Like realistically, you'll be adding more every year or at whatever frequency.
All you have to do is open a brokerage account with, like, you can do it online, like with Fidelity or E-Trade or like Charles Schwab. You transfer like some money from your bank account into that account. And then I would just invest in the S&P 500 or any fund that mostly traces the S&P 500 because that will always go up. Basically, all the investors know that if you are buying cryptocurrencies or trying to buy Amazon before it goes up even more or whatever, it's basically like gambling where you might gain the next day, you could lose. So it's like high risk, high return. You have the same chance of losing a shit ton as you do of gaining. But if you put it in the S&P 500 and you don't look at it and you just put in more every year, like you don't look at what time you do it because you can't predict when it's going to go up or down, but you do know that in the long term, it will go up guaranteed 6% on average at the worst case scenario year over year. So that like takes out the risk basically. And you're getting a much higher return than in the bank.
Yeah. And I always hear like, I think the fallback phrase that I hear all the time is like the market will correct itself, is that it's like consistent and it will go up. But like in a context where like people don't have many avenues for savings, right? So it's like, for me, the way that I would want to do it is that like I have my salary, I have some of it that goes into savings, and then I have some of it that goes into investing, right? Mm-hmm. But like my always fear and fallback is like, what if I lose my job, right? Due to like a recession, right? And the market takes a dip. Guaranteed, I'll have the savings that are in my savings account. But what is my investment portfolio going to look like? And like, if I need the money, I need the money. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to let it sit there in the investment fund just because it's like a bad time and just took a dip. I'm still going to take out that money because I need to do it like to pay bills and shit. So like, what would you do in that scenario? Because it's like, you know, for me, I feel like there's like a lot of like investment or there's like safety nets you can create for yourself. But it's like, you know, if you have a pie and there's like limited slices of that pie you can give up, like what's the best option?
The general rule of thumb is to have enough in your bank account to pay for 3 months of all your expenses.
Yeah.
So rent, everything in case of an emergency. But of course, like at our age, there's also like we want some liquid income and put it in a house or in case we need to get a new car because our old one breaks down or like another big expense that comes up. And that would be fairly personal. Like it would require a planned process of saving and like seeing like how much you have to save in addition to the 3 months of payments for this goal purchase that you are saving up for. No one needs an investment account if it's a stretch. Some people do like $5,000 a year or $500 a year or just like a lump sum. It has to be like a small enough percentage where you can have enough for emergencies or backups. But
yeah,
there's like to put some amount into and knowing how much it'll grow. It's like how much, like it's like taking out money for your 401k for like out of your paycheck or something. Like it's a very small, like people do like 5 to 10%. If you put like 5% of your paycheck into your investment account at the end of the year, that is stuff that you'll have at retirement.
Yeah.
And I don't think Americans understand like how screwed we are because there's like Social Security is not going to be there when we are old. Like it's very easy to reform, but I doubt it. And the age limit on Social Security is just going to expand to the point where we're probably going to be dead by the time we can actually connect it. Like healthcare expenses and just living expenses when we're old is going to be crazy. And the fact that investing comes with like a limited, like such a high barrier to entry, it's like difficult because you need, like not everyone can do it. Like it's very privileged. And the fact that like we have to rely on it so much as a country to get through our old age.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. Like the fact that it's set up like that because we don't have a good social security, like social system set up.
And what about like IRAs, right? Like I have a 401k, but should I also have an IRA?
IRAs are good because it's like it's only taxed when you take it out, but that's like for very long-term thinking. Like that would be, you would be putting your retirement savings into your IRA.
Yeah.
And then a Roth IRA is something that people start if I think the salary limit was like six figures or something. It might have raised it. But if it's below that, you can put it in a Roth IRA and then it's not taxed when you take it out. So assuming it's going to be way bigger when you take it out than when you put it in, like you're paying taxes on the $10,000 you put in now.
Cool. That's interesting. And I also think like, and I also thought about that, like in terms of milestones, but like, I feel like I'm dipping into my savings all the time. Like, I'm just like, oh, I racked up like a little too much of my credit card bill this month. Like, I'm gonna pay it off with my savings or like stuff like that, you know? So, and I know like, and that's like, and I've heard of the formulas, right? Like you don't want to spend more than like a third of your gross income on like living, right? On rent.
On rent. Yeah. Which is so hard.
Which is super hard. But also it's like, that means half my paycheck. Like at the end of my pay period, I only have about like 60% of my paycheck of my like gross income.
Because of the taxes.
Because of taxes. Which is cool. Like I, for me, like, you know, super socialist, I'm like, yeah, it's like paying for good things. It's paying for school. It's paying for whatever, like whatever.
The military mostly.
The military, obviously, but like, you know, like it is what it is. So like I pay my taxes and I have 60% of my gross income left. That means like the recommended amount or like the max I can pay for rent is half of my paycheck. And like, that's so hard. Like finding an apartment that is less than half my paycheck, I feel like is like pretty hard. So it's like, it's weird, right? Cause it's like the thing that I hear, like the metrics I hear are like, okay, like don't spend more than a third of your gross income on rent. Have 3 months worth of your salary or 3 months worth of expenses in savings just in case. Like that's a good safety net. And then like put some money into your retirement fund and then put some money into your like investment fund for like short-term gains or whatever. And I'm just like, where the fuck, when the fuck do we stop? And also it's like, now it's like, you know, a little bit more of my pie is taken up. And I feel like, you know, we're in the era of subscriptions. So it's like everyone's nickel and diming me every month for my money. So it's like Netflix is taking my money, you know, Hulu's taking my money. You know, like Apple Cloud's taking my money. So it's like a little bit more chunk of that monthly income that I can't just allocate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess like I think that's also the barrier too. It's just like I don't like thinking about finances. Like I don't like thinking about my money. All I want is that I'm not in debt. So it's like, you know, I'm very comfortable like shoving an amount in my 401k because it's like all taken care of by my company. And then shoving some money into like a savings account.
Yeah, I feel like the people who are making all those rules about 30% rent are people who are in positions where they don't even think about that because it's just like so affordable or whatever and normal. Yeah. And like that's the people who are promoting financial literacy or teaching about that are basically in the same boat. And it sucks because yeah, rent is like in theory 30%, but rents have grown like twice as quickly as wages have been in the past decade. So Who the hell is going to be able to pay 30% of like find a place that costs 30% of their income? That's just, it's less possible. And that's why more and more people are rent burdened now than ever before. And investing is hard. Like it takes a shit ton of resources. And my parents, like, they have resources to invest and they'll just avoid the stock market altogether because they have this fear that, like, they think one day China's going to take over the world and the U.S. government and, like, it's going to collapse. But on top of that, they also have this fear of, like, putting their money anywhere that's not their own account and they even, like, keep a lot in cash because they're just scared that the government or the economy is going to make it disappear. I think that comes from living in a politically unstable country when they were growing up where they couldn't trust the financial systems. And I'm like, you guys are literally losing so much money every year.
Yeah. And it's crazy. The story that I hear all the time is like my family lost, like it's weird, right? Cause my parents like grew up like super affluent and wealthy. And what really fucked them was like the Asian market crash in 1999. Like, I don't know, like, the actual details of that. Like, I know some of the details, but not really, about, like, the actual history behind the market crash. But I know that, like, my mom's parents had a lot of money. And there was, like, a saying, like, back in their day that, like, you can't step into this town without stepping on, like, my mom's family's land. So it's like my parents like both grew up like super wealthy, super privileged. And I like, and I had some of that too when I was still living in Korea, you know, like when I was born, like they like would take me to the mall, buy me everything I wanted, all of that. Or at least like that's the stories I hear. And then we lost all of it. And then we came to America. And then, so it's weird like talking to my parents now because it's like they're also not financially literate because it's like they're both like we have a socioeconomic and generation gap between like me and my parents because it's like I try to talk to them about money or about things like that. They're not literate because like they always had people that did that for them. So it's like really weird. And it's like my parents' spending habits, like they don't spend money like poor people. I now make like more than my parents by like a significant multiple. But still, you know, like my mom's spending habits are crazy in my mind. She's just like, you know, like on top of like feeding the whole family, she's just like, I'm going to buy a new couch this month. And I'm like, Mom, that's insane. I was like, that's like $3,000. Like why? Like why, you know?
I feel like the way that you're raised or how you grow up and how you're used to spending money impacts you kind of for the rest of your life unless you actively work to change it. Yeah. And it's like, it's really difficult to convince our parents to take it seriously, to take saving seriously, because I mean, I think they also grew up in places where like the old people were in the country were like fine, like the country, they lived good lives. And like, yeah. I don't think anyone thinks about how scary our retirement is going to be and how yeah. like, we need here in America, which is why I'm planning on just moving to Italy or some other, or like Japan once I retire, because I don't want to deal with like here, but
yeah,
that also takes money. So
what's crazy is that my grandparents are citizens here and they take Social Security, because like my grandma and grandpa, they're citizens and they get Social Security and they live in a government subsidized housing for seniors. But like I'm undocumented, my parents are documented, my sister's undocumented. So it's like sometimes it's like a little jarring for me, because it's like I think like if my grandparents also weren't citizens and they weren't like they didn't get income from the state, like what the state of our family would be. Like it's crazy to think about, I feel. My parents and my sister and I are undocumented also.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wait, do you mean like not a citizen or like actually like
no? Actually undocumented.
How did that happen?
It's shitty because here's the situation. The reason we're undocumented is because when we were growing up, my grandma and grandpa would always come to the States because they put my uncles through college in America. So there were those like international, like rich ass Korean kids that were like going to school in the US and just like living baller lives down in San Diego.
Damn.
And like my grandparents like would fly back and forth. So like they submitted their green card application and all of that. When we lost all of our money and we moved to America, we moved here on a vacation visa. And then after a vacation visa, we switched that to a E2 visa, which is like your like business owner's visa. And my dad never applied for a green card because his plan was to take us back to Korea.
Oh. So just that
motherfucker
happened.
That motherfucker didn't even put an application in for a green card. He was like, we're going back to Korea. He's like, this is nonsense.
Oh my God.
So he's sort of like, you know, he gives himself a hard time about it. And like, I can joke about it ish now, but it was like, because everything's 2020 in retrospect, right? Like, I was like, you fucking asshole. Like, you, like, because it didn't cost, like, it cost money to submit the application, of course, but like, not that much. Like, it's not going to cost you anything to put in a fucking green card application. He just didn't do that. And so the thing with the immigration policy is that if you don't maintain the same exact business that you had when you had your E2 visa, then you can't renew. So if the business goes under or whatever, like you can't renew your business visa under the same entity. We moved here in 1999. My dad didn't apply, put us for a green card until like what, 2008? So that whole time. He could have done it while we had legal status, but he didn't. So now the four of us are undocumented.
How has that impacted college or career? like when people ask for documents and stuff, like how does that work?
Well, it's better-ish now since like Obama's like deferred action program. But like when you and I were going to high school, you guys remember like I didn't drive.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I didn't drive and I couldn't get a license because I was undocumented.
Okay.
And then I couldn't apply for federal funding or even like subsidized loans. And because my parents didn't have social security numbers, they also couldn't get like regular loans for me to go to school right after high school. So it's like right after high school, like I had already declared that I was going to go to like UC Santa Barbara, but like we just didn't have the money for me to go. So then I went to community college. And then by that time, like the Dream Act came out for California. So there was going to be there were like grants available for undocumented children that went to high school in California. So that was good. And then Obama's like DACA program came out. So which means that I could get a Social Security card to work. And the way that the program works is that I renew it every 2 years. So it's like the federal government says, I tell the federal government like, hey, I've been here since I was really young. I went to high school here. I went to college here. I want to work here. So give me a work permit and a Social Security card so I can pay taxes and then defer my deportation every 2 years. So it's like because like a deportation order was never filed for me, like in the event that the government wants to put like say they want to deport me, I can defer that like for 2 years. So every 2 years I have to renew it. But that also means like I can't travel internationally. There's this thing called like advanced parole. So it's like they'll do like special cases. So when I was in community college, there was like an international debate tournament in China. I got to go to that because the dean of the school like actually wrote me a recommendation letter for me to go.
Oh, wow.
To China for 2 weeks. And so that was really cool. But like it's I can't, that means like in general, like I can't travel internationally. And also like if I got a DUI like a couple when I was like when I just turned 21, that could have impacted the way I renew my paperwork because that was like a misdemeanor. Even though it was a misdemeanor, it was like a misdemeanor involving like controlled substances because of alcohol. And so that like could have impacted. So it's like, and for me, like that means like I also can't like make dumb mistakes. Like I also can't go to a Black Lives Matter protest and get arrested because then I can't renew my paperwork anymore.
And this is definitely not talked about enough.
No, because I think it's really easy for people to think about Mexican people being undocumented because y'all share like, you know, we share a border, right? But for Asians, it's like a whole fucking ocean, you know, like how are people sneaking in this country? You know, people can imagine like, oh, like, you know, people like, you know, roughing the desert and like getting into like, you know, getting into the states from by crossing the border. But like, how are people like coming here illegally as Asian people? And I also feel like because we're model minorities, like, you know, people don't talk about us. They're like, oh, like, you know, Asian people don't commit crime.
Yeah, people don't talk about Asians in general, let alone, yeah, like, any exceptions. And it's like, everyone talks about DACA, but yeah, that's just, like, under this image of, it's, like, in conversation with Trump's, like, border and shit. And, like, it is just referring to people coming from Mexico.
Yeah.
And I, like, even from this conversation, I'm realizing, like, wow, I don't know shit about this. And I, like, don't think people do. Like, documented people don't know shit about this. Or no. Like how important it is. Like what would happen if like with like what's happening with DACA and like if the Trump hasn't gotten rid of it, has he?
He tried to, but the court stopped it. They're like, you can't, it's not constitutional. You can't just like stop this program.
Okay.
Like
what would happen if that went away?
I mean, I'd be fucked because if, you know, another thing about me is that like for Korean people, like there's compulsory military service.
Oh shit.
So if I go back, like I'm going straight into the military. So like not only am I going back to a country I don't fucking know, but I'm going to serve the country that I don't fucking know for 2 years minimum. So I'm basically dodging the draft in Korea. But it's like, here's the thing. Like, I, you know, even when, like, you know, undocumented, like, amnesty and all of that stuff was, like, still a hot topic. Like, it was, like, a super hot topic, I feel like, back in 2008. You know, people were being polled, and they were like, do you think undocumented people should be able to go to our schools here? And people were like, yes. And they were like, oh, like, do you think that, like, you know, undocumented people should be able to drive? And they're like, yes. But it's like, they should be able to get access to these things. And then when people were like asked, like, should undocumented people be given a path to citizenship? People were like, no. And here's the thing that really kills me sometimes is that I pay taxes, but I can't I don't qualify for any of those social programs.
That's so fucked up.
You know, like, I, and like the way that I see it is like, I benefited from going to like public high school. So that was cool. You know, I didn't have to pay for UCI at all because the government paid for it. California paid for it. That's pretty cool, you know? So it's like, you know, that's what I think about, like, my tax dollars going to now. And then, like, specifically my grandparents, you know what I mean? Because they're on Social Security. So I'm like, cool, you know? But it's weird to think that I'm just in this limbo because my only path to citizenship now is just marriage. There's zero other way. I think there is a scenario where I can get a company to sponsor me, potentially. But that requires working at a company that will pay to do that. And I think you have to be at the company for a minimum 3 years. So it's like if you get fired, if you want to quit before that time, then your status gets taken away. And also, like, that's also something that I don't trust a company with. Like, I'm not going to give them, like, my freedom to, like, live in this country as leverage, you know? And again, there's another fucking loophole that's, like, for rich people, which is, like, the A5 green card. If you invest $500,000 into any U.S. company, you automatically get this green card, like, no questions asked.
Mm-hmm. And if you buy if you spend, like, $1 million on property.
Yeah.
You automatically get it. It's so fucked up.
Yeah. And it's, like, and you know the quotas, right? Like, every country and every type of green card is allowed only X amount of slots. So it's like, let's say, like, you know, everyone that immigrates from South Korea, we only can give out 200 green cards for that country. So that's why green card applications are also a pain in the ass too, because it takes years for them to get to your green card application. Like, my parents submitted our green card application in 2008. It's about to open up right now.
Holy crap.
So it's been 12 years since we submitted our application that's being reviewed now. But if the quotas aren't met, so this A5, I forget how many slots this A5 green card has, but let's say, like, not all of them gets issued. It doesn't get reallocated to anywhere else. That's it. Like, that's just that. That's just for millionaires.
That's just so messed up.
Yeah. So they're not like, okay, so there's, like, you know, five of them that are left over this year that didn't get issued. Let's reallocate them to, like, a different country or a different type of green card. Nope.
It's like there's bureaucratic processes set up just to fuck with people. Like, they could so easily change a few lives with that. Like, by just, like, doing that extra paperwork or just filling up that slot.
For me, it just feels like an afterthought. For them, it's just like, oh, we have these leftover. What should we do with them? And they're just like, leave them.
Yeah, because it's so, like, it doesn't affect them so much. Like, they can't even think about.
Yeah, they're like, fuck it. Who cares?
And it's like when people talk about how undocumented people still pay taxes and how great that is. But it's like no one talks about the fact that you don't get any of the social services that taxes go towards. And there's so much reform that's needed for that. But, like, you don't hear about it enough.
I mean, but what else, like, are you going to do, you know?
Now that I'm thinking about it, it's like everything that came out of social media movements or people actually demanding rights, it's turned into some bullet point on a politician's agenda. Like, Black Lives Matter, great. Now we have Kamala Harris, great. But, like, are they actually going to do any policies about it? Probably not.
No, it's crazy. And it's like the other thing about Kamala Harris that, you know, I've been hearing about is just like her time in California wasn't well spent because she was lobbying basically for for-profit prisons.
Representation is one thing, but just because someone represents a group of people doesn't mean that they will be the person that does what's best for them. No. And Kamala Harris is like the example of that, where she is like very explicitly harming the group that she represents.
Yeah, or like, I mean, it's come to the point where like they're so, even if there is some representation, it's not enough, right? Like, it's almost like if you're the one Asian friend in your friend group, like you get tokenized a lot because like you are the only representation of Asian people like in your friend group, right? And then now everything that you say is now on behalf of like all Chinese people and or all women, you know? And so I feel like I agree with you in the sense that like representation doesn't always have the outcome. But I think that like we're looking at specific examples of representation where there's so few in the forefront, you know, like
exactly
so few Black women are being represented in like politics.
So they get judged way more.
Not even judged way more. It's just that like, because it's just like a small, I guess, like if I want to be fancy and use like a stats term here, it's like a small sample, right? It's not a like statistically significant sample. Like it's like a bunch of it's like a group of outliers in a sense, right? Like for example, like let's say you want 5 Black women to represent all Black women in the United States. I mean, that's inherently also like flawed, right? Like the thing is, it's like the more of the same type of person needs to be in a room, or more than 5 or more than 10, opposed to like the hundreds that you're facing, because, you know, like you're right. Like, you know, Kamala Harris doesn't speak for all Black women or all Indian women for that matter, you know, like, it shouldn't just come down to her. It should just be like a group of Kamalas, you know, like a group of women of color, like that are representing like women and women of color, not just like 5 women in a room against like the white heterosexual patriarchy.
People talk about, and I talk about, this juxtaposition between her race and her actions towards like people in her racial group.
Yeah.
But it's like, no white, like, you have Trump and you have Bernie Sanders, you have a whole spectrum of white dude. No white dude is taking it personally and saying like, oh, you know, Trump does something that is harmful for like poor white dudes, and like, or, and Bernie does something that's harmful for rich white dudes, and therefore they shouldn't represent white dudes. Like, no one is even thinking that. They can just be politicians and do policy.
Exactly.
And no one's like judging about their bullshit.
Yeah. Because also like white constituents can say like, oh, like my representative did something like super racist the other day, but that doesn't represent all white people.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know what I mean?
Like Kamala Harris did, then like she does represent like.
Yeah.
Her. I don't know.
Yeah. Cause like tokenizing only works for the other, right? Like, you know, no one is looking at like racists out there, and like white people are the first to say like, oh, like just because like this crazy racist on TV said something, that doesn't mean all white people are racist. But that's a given, right? Like people don't automatically feel like they have to defend themselves and their identity against what's being represented in the media because he's just another crazy racist dude. Like, I'm not like that. Whereas like, you know, when people like come at AOC and they're like, oh, like that's why women should be in politics. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like dumb bullshit like that.
I hate that. She is such a badass.
Yeah. And like, I would say like, what's also weird about that is just that like, I'm such a single issue voter. I'm like, you know, whenever I'm evaluating like any politician, I'm just like, what's your immigration policy and what is my path to citizenship look like? That it's just like, I've basically like tuned out the rest of politics. And I'm like
the one that's most important.
Like, yeah.
Integral to you.
Yeah. I'd be like, yeah, cool. Like it'd be great if we had like social programs. Like, oh, it'd be great if we had like a better support network for like homeless people. Like it'd be great if we had like X, Y, and Z, but ultimately I'm just like, am I going to get a green card? Yes or no. If it's no, like move along. I don't need you here. And it's like, and it's not even like that I can vote, you know? And so it's like, I feel like that's a frustrating part to me too. It's just like, why fucking bother? Like I can't vote. like, of course, like, I can try to convince however many people to root for my cause, but like, that's where it ends for me, because it's like, you know, like, no one's ever really going to understand my experience. One aspect of me is just like, yes, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, if I continue to not speak up, if I continue not to talk about like my story, then people are still just going to stay ignorant. And like, you know, what am I doing besides perpetuating the status quo? And then the other half, which is like, you know, I should be more of an advocate. I should be doing more research, but it's like, I got enough shit to worry about. Like, I have like my parents to worry about who aren't working during COVID. Like, I have my grandparents to worry about. Like, I have my siblings to worry about, you know?
The U.S., by like excluding populations of people, like, it cannot expect that people will care about policies if like they're fundamentally excluded from the benefits of it. Like, it totally makes sense why you feel that way. And that's just another thing that politicians and the U.S. needs to do better at. And it's also like, I do think talking about it is important, because voting like is integral, but it's also the least that anyone can do to participate.
Yeah.
Making change, because one vote at the end of the day, it's like, I mean, a lot of people don't vote because they're like, well, what's my vote gonna do? Collectively, a shit ton. But like, the fact that you can't vote doesn't disqualify you from like being able to take a shit ton of actions. And maybe that is just like talking, like this conversation that we're having, it's already just informing so much for me and therefore my social circles, and it just like expands in that effect. But without talking about it, like, who's gonna know?
Yeah.
And that's what's shitty, because it does put the burden on you. And it is like the fucked up part about all of this. But
how have like our immigrant parents like basically like shaped our way of like thinking about like money and the economy and like politics? Like, tell me more about your parents. Like, you know, like, they fled communist China. They came to the United States.
They're different from a lot of other Chinese parents, because they actually grew up thinking that the Chinese government is amazing and they has no problems. And they left because they wanted to, like, they were left in the 90s when doctors were making the same as taxi drivers, and they just finished med school and they're like, okay, let's go out of the country to get like more money and to give Fangxi a better education. But like, they came to the States, they came to all these countries, and they were like, yeah, China is still perfect and we are Chinese people and we will never abandon our country. And like, we never got citizenship until very, very late out of choice. So they're like, they have a lot of hometown pride.
That's crazy. And,
like, here, even now, they still love China. And like, they talk about how much socialism was great. And my mom's like, my mom literally just like bought a Louis Vuitton purse in Vegas one time, and she was standing outside the store taking pictures of it. And then she was like, I miss growing up in China when everyone was happier because we never had to compare ourselves to other people. And we were just living life. And I just think the society should be like that. And I was like, Mom, you just like spent like my rent on a purse. Like, what are you talking about?
That's crazy.
I bet you miss socialism. That's like their thoughts, and very much for universal healthcare, because they worked in a healthcare system and they were like, privatized healthcare does not work, because China tried to do that when it first liberalized and then failed. So, and my dad was like working through that. But besides that, they've been like Republicans or Trump supporters from the start, because I think there's something about being a Republican that has this feeling of the American dream and like elitism associated with it, at least for them. Cause it's like, oh, this is what like people who don't want to pay more taxes support. And we don't want to pay more taxes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, y'all aren't part of that.
Yeah. And it's crazy how like, you know, like my parents, like my mom's like a full-time waitress. My dad, like his business doesn't really like make that much money, but like for them, like, sometimes they have such like conservative values. I'm just like, where's all this coming from? You know what I mean? A part of me thinks that like Asian people are sometimes like so good at assimilating when we come to the States, about like embracing like some of the ideals, that maybe that might be a part of it too. Cause you know what I mean? Cause my parents are like, you know, like, oh, like Asian people, like we're great immigrants. Like, you know, we work really hard. Like, we don't commit crime. And then I think, like, you know, foundation, like, part of it's like racist too, right? Because it's like, oh, like, you know, brown people, they're lazy. But
oh, yeah,
immigrants, like, we're not lazy. And we're like, we deserve our money. Like, we should be, our money shouldn't be going towards like socialist causes. And you're like, mom, like, we're on Medicare. Like, I was like, mom, like, we don't pay for health insurance. Like, we're on Medicare. Like, if any of us get sick and have to go to like the, like, take the ambulance and go to the hospital, like, we're fucked, you know? But also, like, you benefit from these like public programs. So it's like, what are you talking about, you know?
Yeah, I don't think they understand that. It's like that connection just isn't there. It's like, for my parents at least, like, they don't want to pay for other people, but yeah, they would like to have these services themselves.
Yeah.
Like, if I were to ask them, how does free college education sound? How does free healthcare sound? Or like public healthcare or whatever, they're like, yeah, that sounds great. It's like, do you like, and then if you talk about taxes and they're like, no. And it seems like they're more split on the economic issues, but they're very much so conservative on the social issues, and that's what sways them, because the social issues is like where people make the emotional appeal, and I think that can like be much more powerful than the policies, even for like anything else.
Yeah,
like the economic policy.
And that's like the same for like, I feel like it's similar to what like white blue collar people are going through too. Like, they're also, I mean, I feel like them as like a voting group, like, also focus on like the social issues, because it's like, you know, why aren't we getting angry at like the fact that people can't like work minimum wage and like afford to put food on the table? You know, like, why do people have to work multiple jobs that pay minimum wage in order to like pay for like an apartment or like food? You know, like, the establishment has done such a good job of making us like look at each other and be like, why aren't you doing better, instead of being like, no, like, how about like we as a people like get paid just more, you know?
It's so much easier to just like point fingers at people. And it's almost from like internalized hate or internalized fear or internalized racism. It's like, I don't want to be like that. I'm not like you because I'm better, because I did this that got me out of this situation. Therefore, you can do that too. And it comes from like that othering.
Right. And like, what's really weird about my parents is like the impression that I always got from them was just like, how corrupt Korean politicians are, and like just their general like distrust of people and like being scammed. So I'm just like, for them, like, I'm just like, how do you trust the government but not trust the government like this much at the same time? Like, you think everyone's a crook? Or like, sometimes like we'll be watching the Korean news and like my grandma would be like, oh, like, he's a commie, and I'm like, Jesus, grandma. Like, she's like, no one really like trusts, I feel like, the government. Or like, there's always something going on in the Korean news where like a public official took a bribe from Samsung.
Oh my God.
Like, you know, so for me, it's like really interesting to see them like distrust the government, but like also trust the government at the same time, if that makes sense. But thankfully, like, my parents aren't like Trump supporters. They're just like, he is insane. And I feel like, I don't know what like Chinese news outlets say about Trump, but like my parents like read the news, and I don't think there is a Korean publication that they're reading that says like Trump is good. They're just like, he's insane.
My parents, I don't think they support Trump anymore, but they voted for Trump in 2016, and I didn't talk to them for like a few months. They it was also just a year of fighting about what they were going to vote for. And they were like, Trump. And anyway, my parents get their news from WeChat. So like, whatever their Chinese friends are sending around on there, that's where they get
that's
their news.
That's crazy.
And they don't even know how to read the news on like in newspapers. My dad had me sign up for like his news alerts on the Apple News app, and he was like, I want to subscribe to politics, but I don't want to see anything about Black Lives Matter or race or poverty. I only want to see what's happening with like what's happening in the White House. And I was like,
Dad, what the fuck?
And then I was like, you can Google that. I'm not going to help you set that up because that goes against my morals. Yeah. And he was like, well, how do I Google? How do I know which news articles are okay? And I'm like, yeah, they don't have a sense of which websites lean in which direction. And at home, they're always playing CNN or Fox News, and they don't really know the difference. And like, they're just like, okay, Fox sounds really dumb today. Okay, CNN sounds really negative today, but they don't have a preference. And it's all just like news to them and everything is like real. But with Trump, it's like they've recently stopped liking him because of how, like, they want to de-escalate tensions with China so that they can actually go back to the country and see our family members. And they don't think that's going to happen with Trump in office because of terrible foreign policy and racism.
But, well, it is the Chinese virus, Nancy. And I personally hold you accountable. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Have you, like, faced any weird racism because you're Chinese?
I have.
And COVID, I mean. Like, not racism in general, but, like, specifically to COVID.
Surprisingly, I haven't since being back. But I remember when I was coming to California, I was my apartment in New York to the airport. And just on that train ride alone, there were three instances where all times an old white dude asked me if I was Chinese and then asked me about my thoughts on COVID. Like, just casual conversations. And I was like, how did you, like, I wonder why you thought to ask me that.
Yeah. You're like, I don't know. I just think it's just like, it's so weird, right? Because it's like, you can, I don't think I can ever find like and I hate using this phrase, like the reversed racism of that. You know what I mean? Like, I can't find a version where you can do that to white people and they'll actually get offended because they don't get it, right? Like, they're just like, oh, like, let me ask you. It's an Asian topic and like you look Oriental. Like, let me talk to you about like an Asian thing.
Yeah. It's like when they ask, like, where are you from? And then whenever I think I'm smart by retorting, where are you from? And they're proudly saying like Germany and like Sweden or whatever. Yeah. And I'm like, nothing I say is like reverse racism doesn't even work.
No. Or they're like, will you take us to Din Tai Fung? And you're like, please stop.
Oh my God, that's definitely happened at work.
No, people ask you to take them to Chinese restaurants, Nancy.
Well, it's more like, let's go to a Chinese restaurant. You know which one, right? And it's like, you know what we should order, right?
No, you fucking.
But you know, everyone is so nice about their microaggressions these days. I can't even like, I feel like I'm the bad guy if I call them out for it. It's like,
no.
Like, how do you deal? I don't understand.
I don't know how to deal with that either. Cause it's like, I don't know. I think I talked to you about this before where it's like as a model minority, I'm just like, it doesn't feel as aggressive. You know what I mean? Like, it just feels like I go back and forth between like, am I overreacting if I'm like saying something about it? But it's really fucking annoying. Like, I told you about that coworker that was like, she asked me where to get udon noodles. And I told her like from like the Japanese market. And like when she, and I was like, when she asked me, I was like, how do I feel about this? You know, but it's like, is that a microaggression? Is it, not? No. But did it feel weird? Maybe. I mean, I just really do like the fact that they're like, let's go to a Chinese restaurant. They're like, oh, like, you know, which one?
Yeah.
Like you're like, where do the Chinese like to eat Chinese food? We want like an authentic experience.
It's just like assumed at that point. Like, it's not even like,
yeah,
I don't even know. But I'm the one, I was thinking about this. I'm like, would I rather them like be like kind of explicit about knowing that I'm different or like racially, or would I rather them take the colorblind approach and treat me the same? I think it would be like, I think I like it much more that they actually ask me rather than being like, oh, who knows of a good Chinese restaurant? And then I'd be like, well, obviously I do.
Well, I think that's still a good, I think it's weird, right? Because it's like, if someone's like, if let's say like you and your team were in a room and someone's like, oh, we should get Chinese restaurant, like we should get Chinese food for lunch today. Who has a great suggestion for Chinese food? The silent like head turn will be like in your direction, I'm sure. That's but like, true. I, you know, but it's like, even that happens, like whatever, but you're still like opening it up to the group. And also like, I don't know. I think it's just about assumptions too, right? Like, what if like you hate Chinese food? What if like you are Chinese, like ethnically, but you like, you grew up in Connecticut. And you never had Chinese food. I'm assuming Connecticut has trash Chinese food, you know, or like Kentucky, like, I don't know, like somewhere these states I imagine will never have like really any kind of Chinese food besides like, I guess, like Panda Express.
I guess maybe I'm less offended because I actually was born in China and I'm actually very proud of my culture.
Yeah.
And I'm very knowledgeable about it too. So it's like different, but it is offensive. Like to just assume that someone knows it, because you're basically calling them out as like, I don't think you're American because you could have been raised in Connecticut, which is the whitest place on earth. But yeah.
I grew up in Greenwichville. Like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Like Chinese food, what? I think the comment back is just like, oh, like what's the harm? But it's like, it's not that people that know you that do those things most of the time. It's just like random strangers most of the time, you know? Like just casual people at work. They're like, oh, like what's a great Chinese food restaurant to eat at? And you're like, what if next time you should just be like PF Chang's? You're like,
I totally do that.
Yeah, you're like, the avocado egg rolls are to like die for. So
wait, actually, I just remembered there's always like a white dude who is the foodie who like has an opinion on everything cultural, yeah, or ethnic. Yeah. And it's like, we had this came up at like this Asian American Affinity Network group, I think we were talking about.
That's a, okay, first of all, pause.
I know.
The Asian Affinity Network? Come on. Asian Affinity Network just sounds like a bunch of like white dudes that are like super into anime and they're looking for like their first Asian girlfriend. Like, that's what that sounds like.
Yeah, it's mostly, it's like the three Asian people in the whole office. There is always that one white dude who knows everything about ethnic food and has an opinion. And one time, like at that network, he did bring up something about avocado, like spring rolls or avocado, like something Asian food.
Yeah.
And was just so excited about it and was such an expert on it, apparently, and like blogged about it. And I was like, shut the fuck up. Like, I was honestly, you guys were like appropriating our culture.
Yeah. But you're also like, Asian people don't like, there's no avocado trees in Asia.
Like, my parents and I hate avocados. I think we're allergic to them. Like, my throat clenches up when I eat avocados.
Oh my God, 100% you're allergic then. Oh my God. Even if we want to change the economy, right? Or like, we want to like talk about the economy. I feel like, you know, there's like more than half the population. Like, one, like it's rare to find women in your field. And it's hard to find like women of color in your field. And like, so I just feel like, I don't know. I think like representation matters a lot in those conversations, because it's like when people are talking about the economy, like they're always going to talk about it from like their context. You know what I mean? So I also just feel like, you know, sexism is like part of the things that like inhibits like our growth and learning, right? Like, you know?
Yeah. Cause you're missing out on so many different angles.
Men are trash. We're such garbage people that we think it's appropriate to have too many drinks at a event that one of our vendors is throwing and hit on the main speaker. That's still, Nancy, this sense of injustice that I feel on your behalf is insane. Like, the fact that some fucking bro thought it was appropriate to hit on you like during a Q&A session after you're the keynote speaker is crazy to me.
It's just so disrespectful. And before that, I really just, it's always been on the back of my mind, like, will people take me less seriously because I am a woman and I'm also the only woman on stage and the only woman of color and the only person of color in this whole freaking room.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of times after work or after an event that I speak at when there's a happy hour or mingling, and then like people will come up to me and they'll be hitting on me and like, or ask questions like about econ, and then I feel a hand around my shoulder and I'm go away.
No.
You get so used to it. I don't know. No, you never get used to it, because every time someone catcalls me when I'm walking down the street, I still just get so pissed off. But the reaction now that I give is, one, like if someone is staring at you on a subway and just like flirting with you or like being gross, I just pick my nose and I stare at them and then they get grossed out.
I think the thing that like makes me feel like wild about it is that like you feel entitled. to be able to say that. Like, you feel like that that's like your God-given right, because it's like, what's the harm? Or like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just that like, oh, like I'm not insulting you.
It's so not it's even like, what's the harm. It's like, yeah. I did you a favor.
100%. Yeah.
And like, if I don't respond or if I look grumpy, they're like, you're a bitch.
All right, so that's the end of the episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. I know that ending was a little bit abrupt. I reorganized the timeline of a lot of the conversations we had. We were talking for a few hours, so I just wanted to like make sure that the order was somewhat more sensible to someone who was listening, who wasn't us talking. And I am thinking of starting a Patreon to have some of the content that I cut out from our conversations with David, the past ones I've had with Adam and Rachel and Isaac, where I can upload some of the cut content onto a Patreon page, maybe something that I will do in the future. Those comments are all there, but definitely open to thoughts. If you guys have any preferences, please let me know. That being said, remember to rate, comment, and subscribe to this podcast, and I will see you in the next episode. I'm going to be talking a lot more about economics and personal finance, as well as like immigrant parents and what it means to grow up first gen, how our parents think about like gender and race and economics and politics coming up. So look forward to that and make sure to follow us on Instagram at POC Podcast. I will see you in the next episode. Bye.